One of the best things about the 21st century has been the variety of creative ways radio has evolved.
Really? That's one of the best things? It's not been the best century, then.
It's been slim. But the legacy of Marconi is in good hands with Alex Lefchik and the Midweek Drivettes. So we got that going for us.
Which is nice.
There's a road sign in Lincolnshire, which I frequently tend to use as an example of what we should have at the focus of being behind the wheel. It says, quite simply, better drivers arrive alive. But how do you become a better driver? And do you become more anxious if you put off taking your driving test until, I don't know, maybe you're in your 30s or something? Well, it would seem that, according to recent research, driving nerves are a challenge when it comes to the more chronologically gifted first-time drivers. And to actually talk us through some of the challenges of maybe stalling in public, maybe actually going up on the curb, etc., we're delighted to welcome Churchill's driving expert, the wonderful Nicholas Mantel. How are you, Nicholas?
Hi, good, thanks, Alex.
Now, obviously, I've raised that line about better drivers arrive alive, but there's also a cliche, or there used to be a line, that actually the more mature you were as a driver, in a sense, the better driver you'd actually become. It was rather like the whole notion of the more time you took to pass the test. You know, first-time drivers were not necessarily the best drivers, or first-time test passers, I should say. I mean, looking at some of the stats here, 130,000 drivers who passed their test were aged over 30 each year. Clearly, there are more than 150,000 who were learning to drive last year. So that whole notion of learning to drive later in life is something which seems to be a growing trend, isn't it?
Yeah, and there's many reasons people are learning to drive plus 30. But the top reasons, unsurprisingly, are family or work-related. As part of the Churchill research, we showed that a third of respondents were motivated by wanting to go on trips as the reason they learned to drive plus 30. 24% said it was to visit friends and family easily, and 21% referenced access to work as the reason they learned to drive later. At Churchill, we've adopted a hybrid working approach post-COVID, and several of my colleagues have recently moved out of London to be closer to family, and they're driving for the first time in their 30s, which is quite exciting.
Now, looking at some of the challenges that people have when they are actually driving, perhaps it's not surprising that hill starts are pretty high up there in terms of how you actually cope with them. But in terms of being most concerned, publicly stalling the car, rolling backwards on a hill, again, that hill start, etc., mistiming a roundabout, hitting the curb. I mean, there is that line that when you're actually in charge of a car, you know, you've got a ton of metal there that can, you know, kill people in all sorts of ways. So that's just not surprising that maybe people get anxious about making mistakes when they're behind the wheel.
Yeah, and I think it's perfectly normal to feel nervous when you're driving. And I think that the trick is to find something that can help you alleviate your nerves, something such as bringing a calming passenger along with you, winding down the window to get some fresh air, or potentially even switching off the radio if that's what it takes. Yeah. In our household, whenever we're going on a longer journey, we try and never leave the house on an empty stomach in case we get hangry, and that really helps calm everyone down.
I see that new drivers often adopt coping mechanisms such as driving in the daytime, which I think is perfectly sensible from that point of view. Only driving in good weather, again, I think important from that perspective. Avoiding difficult maneuvers, though, can be a bit of a challenge because sometimes, you know, much as you might hate to actually have a hill start, you'll be faced with it. My own particular bête noire was always the parallel parking. I still actually hate that. Even today, from that point of view, it's just not something I enjoy at all, basically. But, you know, clearly that is also important. I noted that also driving in silence, very significant. This over a third of people like to drive in silence. Presumably that's not to be distracted and to keep your focus on the road.
Yeah, I think that just helps people focus and, you know, just really, I think, helps calm them down. So there's, you know, all of these strategies can be quite personal, you know, so there are some people who, instead of having silence, like to listen to music, and that's something that can calm them down. So I think the trick is to find something that's personal to you and helps calm your own nerves.
Now, this also ties in with that C word, as you mentioned, and of course, that's more than just Churchill, because Churchill has indeed launched its Keep Calm and Drive On campaign. presumably one should never effectively underestimate the needs to actually be a calm driver, because if you're not a calm driver, certainly it's not going to help your passengers if you have any, and it's not going to help your whole experience of driving. So, yeah, again, from top tips for nervous drivers, would you also say just remember to keep breathing is also top of the list?
Yeah, that's probably a good tip for life, I suppose, is to keep breathing.
And what should people actually avoid doing if they are nervous behind the wheel? I mean, we looked at some of the key things that are actually there. It's probably also worth noting that for experienced drivers, that when you see people who are having challenges or you're experienced with them, it doesn't help to start honking that horn, getting annoyed and sort of further challenging that. I think that there needs to be a kind of time out to actually ensure that you don't go down the path of road rage just because you're behind an inexperienced driver.
Yeah, and I think that the call out is to other drivers on the road to be conscious that there are drivers plus 30 who've just learned to drive who aren't feeling as confident. So try and be as patient as possible with these drivers.
Do you think, I think the green L plates that you actually have for people who've just passed their test or just does that work in terms of actually just making people aware of the fact that even if you have passed your test, you're not necessarily going to be as experienced as somebody who's been on the road for a few decades?
Yeah, I think it's a P plate actually, but that's not mandatory, but it does help, you know, give other drivers a visible sign that you've just learned to drive. So that is another way a nervous driver can help signal to other drivers that they potentially have just learned. But not everyone likes to put on a P plate, so I think it's just, you know, being aware: are there any visible signs that a driver might not be as confident on the road as you are? And then, like you said, don't start honking your horn, but try and be as patient as possible.
Is this something that's just unique to Britain? Because I detect possibly a slight South African accent. I mean, are other countries as crazy as us? I mean, people would often say the kill or cure routine, which actually to take your car over to, Paris or Rome.
So I think learning to drive plus 30 is probably not unique to Britain, but especially in South Africa, with the lack of public transport, people do generally tend to learn to drive earlier in life.
And also, I suppose some of the roads are slightly clearer, but never mind. That's a different issue. Where can people go to find out further information about this Churchill campaign? And indeed, if they are thinking about maybe learning to drive and they happen to be in that 30 plus bracket.
So you can go to the Churchill channel on YouTube, where there's advice from other drivers plus 30 who've just learned to drive. Or you can go to churchill.com and search for motor insurance.
Nicholas Mantel, Churchill's driving expert, huge thanks. And continued happy driving, Nicholas.
Thanks, Alex. Cheers.
In my hometown, Lakeshore Drive, the road is called, and it'll take you up or down. From rats on up to riches, 15 minutes you can fly. Pretty blue lights along the way help you ride on by. And the blue lights shining with a heavenly grace help you ride on by. Anywhere I found, running south on Lakeshore Drive, getting into town, and just slipping on by on LSD, riding that trouble bound. Then it starts up north from Hollywood, water on the driving side. Concrete mountains rearing up, throwing shadows just about five. Sometimes you can smell the green if your mind is feeling fine. There ain't no finer place to be than running Lakeshore Drive. And there's no peace of mind the place you see, riding on Lakeshore Drive. Like it anywhere.
getting into town. Just slipping on by on LSD, Friday night trouble bound. Friday night and you're looking clean, too early to start the rounds. A 10-minute ride from the Gold Coast back makes you show your pleasure bound. And it's 4 o'clock in the morning and all the people have gone away. Just you and your mind and Lakeshore Drive, and tomorrow is another day. And the sun shines fine in the morning time, tomorrow is another day. There ain't no road just like it anywhere I found. Running south on Lakeshore Drive, getting into town. And just sneaking on my own LSD, Friday night trouble bound.
Lakeshore Drive, of course, taking us out of the first sequence of the midweek drive, which curiously that features driving, because that's what the whole feature was all about. Specifically, what are the top five mistakes that older drivers are most concerned about making when they're learning to drive? Okay, we've got the midweek drive team gradually assembled now. Let's turn to Tosin Siemi first. Tosin, do you drive?
Oh, in Nigeria, yes, but not yet.
Okay.
So I've learned all over again, basically.
Well, this is true. This is very true. But we'll come across your thoughts about that. And Victoria, do you drive?
Yes, I do.
Excellent.
I haven't had to drive for a very long time. And okay. I haven't had a car. And last week, I actually bought a car because I'm going to pick it up next week or the week after when it's ready. And that will be my first proper car that's mine.
and when you say semi-bought a car, does that mean you get the front half, the rear half?
I get the paperwork. And then I get it when they've put new tyres on it.
Okay. Cathy Manser, we know you drive, so that's important and welcome aboard from that point of view. But I presume from that point of view, in terms of age, most of us then will have actually taken our driving test and learnt to drive in our early 20s or possibly earlier from that point of view. But as we've said, now we have a situation where more people are learning to drive in their 30s. They're making that sort of challenge. And the top five mistakes, and this is where we want to find this whole process out, are in order. Fifthly, hitting the curb. Fourthly, mistiming a roundabout. Very difficult for any American drivers, obviously. Thirdly, rolling backwards on a hill. So difficulty with hill starts. Secondly, publicly stalling a car. 56% worried about publicly stalling the car. And top of the list in terms of mistakes drivers are most concerned about making, moving into the wrong lane. Anna Lewis, welcome to the Midweek Drive. I trust that you TP well. I don't think you drive, do you?
I did actually pass my test in the end, but I've never driven since and I've let my license elapse.
Nice. So you did it just to prove you could do it. And that's it. End of story.
Yeah.
Okay. So from that list then, Victoria, were there any that resonated with respect to yourself, or is it a case of, no, I've been fearless. I passed my test first time. It's not been a problem. What's the challenge?
No, I did pass first time, actually. But I did have a hang-up about hill starts, simply because when I was learning to drive, I was in my grandma's old car that didn't have power steering, and I stalled twice on a hill, and it locked my confidence forever. But when I was test driving, I actually did several hill starts and they're all perfectly fine. The one I have a problem with, which I'm surprised isn't on your list, is parallel parking.
Yeah, you and me both. I hate parallel parking. Always try to avoid that. Tosin, you're nodding with respect to parallel parking. Was that a challenge with respect to yourself, or was it a case of no? In Nigeria, it was just a case of not driving on roundabouts.
It's both of them actually, but the thing about parallel parking, it's been a big fear of mine since I think I was young, like 13. There was a cartoon, Phineas and Ferb, where there was an episode where Candice was trying to parallel park, and it was really hard for her. So since then, I've known about parallel parking, and it's been a fear for me to do. Then when I started driving, I now understood why it was so hard, and it really scared me a lot. But I got used to it. But I probably lapsed because I'm not driving in a while. Well, also the roundabout is a really, really big problem for me. Even in the UK, like once I'm in a car and I'm in a roundabout, I'm always trying to gauge when it's time to go, and I always get it wrong. So that's going to be a very big part of what I'm going to learn when I start my driver's license. Well, I'll say the
Yeah.
roundabout is much more of a problem for me than the parallel parking, to be honest.
Jessica in North Carolina, welcome back to the Midweek Drive. Are you a driver, or is it a case of no? For goodness sake, in North Carolina, as a woman, I always get a chauffeur to drive for me.
I'm actually working on getting my license just because I've been so anxious about driving. My city is like nationally ranked aggressive drivers, so I get very scared and nervous to drive, but I'm working on it. I'm trying, so we'll get there.
So that top five list of fears and the mistakes drivers are most concerned about making: moving into the wrong lane, publicly stalling the car, rolling backwards on a hill, mistiming a roundabout, or hitting the curb. Is it a case of, well, all five of those, basically?
I think for me, actually, I just get terrified of like any time somebody passes me, which is not good if you're gonna drive because it's kind of the whole point. But yeah, that's actually mine. I think
Well,
roundabouts actually seem fun.
yeah, it's one way of actually looking at them. Nicholas Mantel, of course, as we heard earlier, list of things that new drivers do to cope with nerves, and clearly, Anna, you decided, no, I'm just not going to go there, is to avoid difficult maneuvers such as right turns, parallel parking, or indeed hill starts. Secondly, driving during the daytime, only driving in silence, keeping the windows open for fresh air, and only driving in good weather. I mean, Kathy, you drove extensively across America. You obviously desperately to drive on every location report, you kind of make a beeline for the driver's seat. I mean, I keep saying you can't do that in this country, but there we are. Any thoughts from yourself, Kathy, about the driving side of things, or is it just a case of roundabouts, schmoundabouts? Talk to me about alligators.
I mean, I've been driving since I was 15. So, yeah, because that's when you start practicing in my state, because we are a state of farmers, like half the country. And so, 15, you start practicing. 16, you can drive on your own. And I guess out of that list, it's the hills, because I come from a flatland. There are no hills in South Florida. So I have literally no practice with them until I moved to California and actually driving across the country when I had to do my first curves on hills. So that was a fun learning experience. But I guess I come from a big city, so you just kind of have to get used to it. I think I did have a similar fear with parallel parking at first, but eventually you can't avoid it, so you get better. And then once you understand that it's a geometry problem and it's about angles, then it gets easier.
So there we are, Jessica. I'm not sure if that's helped in terms of your steps to becoming a driver, but you obviously have to keep us updated with your progress as we work through that. Anna, you're our official historian, designated in terms of what goes on in terms of London and the sort of things you've been investigating. What can you bring to the Midweek Drive this week?
Ah, oh, well, there you go. Today, I decided to visit a grave in Mortlake Cemetery that belonged to an explorer called Sir Richard Burton. What I wasn't wearing, which I should have taken with me, and I knew this, and I, for some reason, maybe it was me fearing it, I should have taken a pair of walking shoes because you can actually climb up a ladder at the back of the tomb and look inside through a kind of Velux window at the two coffins. I think there's two inside the actual grave. It sounds ridiculous,
It's a
but to
tomb
be
with a
honest,
view.
Oh, it's a tomb with a view, exactly that. And there is a book called Tomb with a View that you have to read. But no, the Richard Burton grave was amongst lots of Catholics in Mortlake. Some really beautiful memorial stones, which I will post on Facebook in the course of the day. But yes, that's the history thing. So interested in a polymath, multilinguist chap to look up, it's definitely Richard Burton, not the actor.
Absolutely essential, and again, known for his somewhat outrageous lifestyle as well, I seem to recall. But in terms of that, I mean, Victoria, checking out graves, I mean, do you feel that's what Mark Zuckerberg actually really set up, or should have set up, the social network called Facebook for, basically?
I mean, he can. It's just I don't think many people would have used it.
And yet it fits so neatly with respect to the formerly known as Twitter site, X as in exit. I mean, there we are. It's clearly sort
yeah,
of
Yeah, I noticed
that
on my phone the other day. And I was like, oh, what have they done? What's happened? But no, the graves, no.
Yeah. Tosin, graveyards in Nigeria, a fun thing to do? Is it a case of we just spend our time looking at the roundabouts?
It's not a fun thing to do. Why would you go to the graveyard? It's so
exactly. Tosin, excellent question. Anna, why?
Yeah, it's a kind of social history in stone. I mean, I don't want to be buried. I want to be scattered in the river or something. I don't want anybody to remember me through the stones. But from a social history point of view, it's really important to respect those testaments of whose people's lives actually were. And not because the bigger the stone, the more important the person is. It's just part of a social history. And I've always loved graveyards. And yes, it's true. It's not the sort of thing Facebook would promote, though there are many groups on Facebook that do. There is actually a website called abilliongraves.com. And there's also another one called Find a Grave. And it's very interesting. People actually take photographs of the gravestone. It offers comfort to people who've moved away from a particular country and they know that their loved ones' graves are looking nice and they can still, you know, remember them on the basis of that. I think it has a purpose, but maybe not Facebook, though. Not for Facebook.
I suppose if there is a proportional representation between the size of the tomb and the importance of the person, then the Egyptians must have been living gods, basically. I mean, those pyramids, massive. I mean, talk about a statement.
That's true. And near me, just a couple of streets away, is a kind of a weird grave to a chap called, and he's totally gone out of my mind, Earl Kilmorey. It's a mausoleum. It looks like it's Egyptian. It's got loads of symbols on it. It's only open 3 times a year. People go there. It is curious to go in and see. He really liked Egyptian stuff, so that's the reason why he built this Egyptian thing to put his lover in and also himself. But very Egyptian.
Makes perfect sense, of course. Jessica, clearly, you know, you're poorly for a few days. You come back, and the first thing you're faced with is people talk about tombs and death and burial. I mean, I appreciate that, but you know, never mind. We know you can hang on in there. Any questions you'd like to put to the team, given that obviously William Coles is umpiring another tennis match? I'll say that again. He's umpiring another tennis match, which is one of the reasons why I haven't driven straight through with Kathy Mansard's cryptic crossword clue. Anyway, over to you, Jessica.
Yeah, now that we're like halfway through August, which is just crazy. I can't believe that this year is kind of in its last half.
America
I'm curious
failed
about
in the World Cup for women, you know. Australia failed in the World Cup for women. Which country hasn't failed in the World Cup for women? Oh, yes, that would be England. Mind you, by the time this is broadcast via the Midweek Drive siren radio slot, who knows what could have happened with Spain. Anyway, sorry, carry on, Jessica.
No, you're good. I was curious about what everyone's like last summer plans are. Do you have a last thing that you're going to do for summer before it comes into September?
Yeah, that ultimate summer plan. I mean, Victoria, is it a case of, well, I'm perspiring over the sheer agony of working with Ryan Jones and Chloe Rose and getting together the first live Simmons Chloe Rose event in November after the wonderful red carpet scenario of my movie in Blackpool? I mean, is that just one of the things that you got in mind?
Before. Yeah, I find August really frustrating because nothing's happening until we get to the 1st of September when everybody goes, oh, okay, we're back from holidays. Now we can start organizing something, Ryan. And so I find if I'm not on holiday or actually got things lined up in August, then I'm really bored. And at the moment, we've got really terrible weather. We're actually wearing trousers in August, and that is unheard of here. Usually, we're retreating to the basement when 40 degrees heat, so we're not happy.
Or possibly kilts, but never mind. That's part and parcel of the whole system. Okay, Jessica, I may have often felt, though it's my academic background, that it was a cruel twist of the planning scenarios that always meant that GCSE and A level results and all the exam results come out at end of August because you're going on quite happily, maybe just sort of busy doing nothing, etc. And then suddenly it hits you with all sorts of other areas from that point of view. But anyway, that's by the by. Jessica, over to you.
Yeah, what? That's cruel. Like you have to spend your whole summer in anticipation of like A level results and stuff.
That's
That's
A
not
levels,
helpful.
GCSEs consistently. It's Scottish Highers. It's probably what made Britain do its thing, really.
I think like I think I was surprised too how some of our results would come after like holidays, but usually in the US, like if my teachers wanted to be particularly horrible, they would give us like exam study packets over Christmas. And that always just felt like disrespectful. You know, it's just not the time. Summer's not the time. Christmas isn't the time. But I guess you have to learn at some point your results, but
Yeah, I mean, Anna, do you remember? I mean, obviously, as a parent as well, probably you've gone through this whole process. I mean, it just seems as though it's and the media go crazy, and you have the exciting shots of people opening their envelopes when things used to be posted through them, or looking at the actual notice on the school board, or checking out their mobile phones. And then there's the heroes, and then there's villains, and there's people saying, "Oh, don't worry, it doesn't mean your entire life has ended age 17 or 18. It's all over now." I mean, any thoughts, Anna?
It's a bit of it is a hype. I remember well watching a program where they went to various schools in Jersey, which is very small and hierarchical as far as schools go. They're state schools, and they're pub. The state schools are very good. Then you've got two or three very private schools that want to give the impression, since you have to pay to go there, that their grades are higher. And of course, what they do to kind of go that way, the more private schools, is they put their young people through more exams than what you would do in a state school. So it does possibly make them look brighter. But no, some of those faces captured by camera are just legendary. I mean, you find the joy and the elation and people jumping like 3 foot in the air. And then you look at the other ones that are sort of cr clutching a Kleenex, feeling very depressed. So it's a bit of a mixed bag, I think, for younger people doing exams.
Thankfully, we can actually go
Yes,
to avatars
definitely.
these days and make sure that we can actually hide behind at least an avatar of joy and happiness. Kathy, does this connect with yourself, or is it a case of, well, for August, I always like to do this, depending on which part of the country or the globe I happen to find myself?
August, I mean, yeah, it's kind of, well, if I'm in Florida, it's just the worst time. It's so hot. It's also hurricane season, and so like it's a different kind of summer by that point, because you're either preparing for something or dealing with a storm, or there's no electricity, so you're just surviving off barely off someone's car air conditioner. But now, as an adult, August is kind of like a wrap-up for me. It's kind of my end of year, not even just academically. I just think it's like you kind of are transitioning, getting ready for the autumn, and there's always something new. This summer for me, I'll be in three countries from August to September. So right now I'm in the Netherlands. It's a good time. I like the Netherlands. The weather's great. It's not like Florida.
Well, Thea van den Bogaert will be back. She just had to take 2 weeks out because she realized Kathy was coming to the Netherlands, so she went to Portugal. It's understandable. If Kathy Mance is coming to your country, you want to get out as quickly as possible. And, hats off to Thea for obviously taking that decision. Tosin, what about yourself in Nigeria and the August days? He will unmute himself, I'm sure. Go.
It's the same for me, like, or for the exam parts where while I was in high school, that was when like most of your results come out. And like your final year in high school, even school certificate to come out, and you know your fate if you're entering uni or not. So it's really a very like stressful month while you're still a student. But like right now, as an adult, it's just chilling and just meet up with your friends in the UK, Nigeria. Just make sure I see a lot of people because a lot of people are busy nowadays and it's not easy to really meet up. So that's my plans for the rest of August. Just meet up with a lot of people and just talk with them and chill with them, basically.
And there was I thinking you'd be currently getting on with a dissertation, but never mind. You know, what the hey, these things actually happen.
That's possible, but dissertation isn't fun. So I'll just leave that out of it.
This is true, exactly. Dissertation, end of September. But you do have an opportunity now with Victoria and with Anna and with Kathy and with Jessica to actually maybe put that question to them that you've put a whole questionnaire about in terms of what your analysis of Balenciaga is all about and shock tactics and PR, etc. So Tosin, the floor is now yours. You have four very stylish individuals, all of whom I'm sure will have a view when it comes to controversy and Balenciaga. And as I say, Victoria is even wearing her Queen t-shirt as we speak. Hey. And Jesse, you can see where we're going here. It's all coming together quite neatly for the benefit of the mind's eye. Over to you, Tosin.
Okay. Real quick. Okay, you guys know what happened to Balenciaga and the ending of last year with the children and the teddy bears that were inappropriate for them, and also the court details on top of a bag for one of our campaigns. So I'm doing a questionnaire about that, and let me quickly pull up the questionnaire for you guys.
He's taking this very seriously. I mean, this is going to be serious stuff on this side of things. It's a questionnaire on behalf of a dissertation. Stuff. You don't get this on BBC Radio 2, and many people will actually say it's the poorer for it. Carry on.
Okay. So I'll also ask like some questions for it because they're kind of a lot. But the first one is, are you aware of the crisis? You guys said yes already. Where did you first hear of like the crisis with Balenciaga? Where did somebody talk to you about it? Was it social media or was it just a news article?
Kathy. Like...
I guess when I first heard about Balenciaga, I think I got to give it to pop culture. So I think the internet, social media, kind of, that's where it came on my radar. Now, I don't really watch Keeping Up with the Kardashians, but it feels like something I would have learned from like clips of that. I needed to be indoctrinated into the UK culture. Okay. I'm glad that they integrated me and I have no regrets.
I watch it too. Okay. Next question. This is for Jessica. How would you rate the way they handled the matter, the crisis that happened, or like the old council culture, or whatever? Do you think that they answered it well, or it was just them running around trying to pick up the eggs they threw on the floor, basically?
Yeah, I feel like when it comes to a lot of these companies that get into controversy, I feel like they're not actually very sorry about what happened or realize their mistake. I think they just want to play cleanup, and I don't think they're actually contrite about it. So I never really can trust like any kind of PR handling, no matter what they do, because I think it's all pretty dishonest and kind of feels like another form of marketing in itself.
Okay, that was a very great answer. Okay, for Victoria. Okay, so my question to you is, I'm coming, give me a minute.
It's the anticipation. He's building this, Victoria, quite deliberately to raise that tension for yourself in France. It's okay.
This in the controversy really alters Balenciaga's image, or was just a one time thing and like they're back to normal?
Firstly, even though I took a degree in fashion at one point, it's not made the news here.
Okay.
In France, it's probably business as normal. I mean, let's face it, controversy in the French fashion industry goes hand in hand.
I think if I'd been in Paris, it would have been like sky high. But where I'm from, you don't get this sort of thing. But I'm definitely with Jessica on it being one of those... there's no bad publicity.
Okay.
Yeah, that's maybe people don't do quite as they should, but
Shows
it
can be
probably
cancelled,
were.
and at the Edinburgh Fringe, it's still going to help the publicity side of things. Still going to get the message out there. Anna, are you as cynical in your base in London, not too far away from Twickenham?
I mean, I must admit, this is the first thing I've heard of this particular thing. So it's taken me a bit by surprise. I've always seen Balenciaga as being one of those really upmarket, rather niche fashion designers who would do things right. But obviously, we're living in a bit of a recession, and I suspect that is driven by the marketing thing. They need to get out there, and they don't think too carefully about how they sell their products. I think it's, and it maybe it was designed to be shockable, maybe it was designed to cause controversy. There's the psychology behind something like that. It's a bit like Benetton and the newborn baby stuff when that came out many years ago, but it's aimed to shock. Maybe this was designed in the same way, just to make people think and make people angry. Negative advertising, possibly. I don't know.
Yeah, the funny thing about them is I think they took a playbook from Benetton, like you said. I read a lot about Benetton from Alex, and they took a playbook for Benetton where they're trying to be controversial but also be on safe line. But with this latest one that happened, they really crossed the line with it. That was where they like it was really, really bad for them, and the negative publicity wasn't really good for them at the end of the day. But like you said, like the news didn't really reach a large amount of people, like at the same time that their brand is still kind of safe relatively. But yeah, that's how it is. I would love to send you guys a questionnaire once we're done, so you guys can just fill it out and
Well,
everything.
there we are. It opens up a whole range of aspects for that, which again teases the whole sequence within that whole system. And I see that, Kathy, would you like to just describe that image you've sent to us on the basis of I can see it, but I can scarcely believe my eyes?
So, just to, because I know we were like, what is it exactly to make sure it was? So, this is what it was commented before. You had children posing with teddy bears that were
In bondage outfits.
bandaged in bondage outfits. It's a lot of black, it's a lot of leather, it's a lot of metal. And
I
you
mean,
see
let's
all the
face it, Anna.
accessories on the bed as well.
This is the sort of thing you might sort of say might be pushing the boundary a wee bit too much from that point of view. But what the hey, there we have it. But thank you for sharing, Kathy. It's nice to know that, and it makes a whole new spin on your cryptic clue. It's interesting that actually the Zoom connection for Kathy is far better now she's in the Netherlands than it ever was when she was in Lincoln. But never mind, that just shows the quality of the Netherlands website, etc. Do you actually have a cryptic crossword clue that you'd like to throw in, Kathy? Because I'd hate you to go off this particular line thinking, darn it, I'd worked so hard to prepare this, and just because Bill Coles wasn't there, they dropped the whole feature.
You know what? I mean, he'll eventually make it back, but that doesn't mean I don't have a clue for you guys. So today's clue is space. So we're filling in the space, empty space, coffee, parentheses, cocktail. And it's a five-letter word, and the middle letter, the third letter, is an I.
Any thoughts on that bizarrely constructed, but nevertheless, probably sincerely meant clue from Kathy? Anna, take that as a no. Victoria.
I need that again.
Yeah,
Okay.
I think so. I
Coffee.
mean, people will be going around a roundabout trying to actually deal with a hill start. They might be very confused now in terms of how this is working.
It's a cocktail that's made up of two words, and you're trying to figure out the first word. The second word is coffee. The first word is a five-letter word, and the middle letter, the third letter, is an I.
Oh, well, Jessica, you should be able to do that straight away because you just come back from the country.
I don't know. I'm
I've put a
Well, it
huge
feels like
clue.
Alex got
I've put a
it.
huge clue in there in terms of a concoction which is served. Yes, Victoria.
Irish coffee.
Yes, Irish coffee.
Take that, Bill Coles. Who needs you after all from that point of view? Next question, of course, Tosin, have you ever availed yourself of Irish coffee as yet? Or is it a case of not really sure how that's going to work?
Not really. How's that going to work? And
okay.
Where can I get it?
Jessica, would you like to describe what exactly Irish coffee is?
It's really good. It's like a hot drink served with coffee. And I think it's best with Jameson whiskey, in my opinion. But it's really great. It's served in like a smaller glass and it just feels so cute. But it's really nice since Ireland has like so many cold, longer nights. So it's just nice to have like something to warm you up.
So it's
okay,
coffee,
we'll try out.
But alcoholic coffee, specifically with, as Jessica would say, Jameson's. Anna, have you partaken of Irish coffee ever in your time?
I have, yes, and it is comforting. It is very nice, especially on a cold night, definitely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, very
so,
nice.
Victoria, in the frozen wastes of France, is there something which you would turn around and say, yeah, it's time in the middle of August to break out the Irish coffee?
Yeah, I've never actually had an Irish coffee because I don't really like too many hot drinks, but I do have quite a large bottle of Baileys in the cupboard, which technically isn't too far from
it. When you say quite a large, are we talking Egyptian tomb sized here? Are we talking sort of mid-range size? I mean, are we talking about...
It was a gift. It's probably standard size, but to me, it's quite large. It's bigger than a whiskey bottle.
Mind you can get miniature whiskey bottles as well, so it's yeah.
No, it's sort of
a substantive.
Twice,
substantive.
It's substantial. Yeah, it's yeah. Quite heavy, so I have to drink some more.
And Kathy, I presume you would say no. I've never tried Irish coffee. I just thought it was an interesting clue.
Why would you assume that? Like, what? I like warm things. You know what I do like more than an Irish coffee, though, because I like my drinking at night. No, no offense to Irish coffee. It's just coffee will keep me up. I prefer a hot toddy.
And there we have it, Jessica, your answer in terms of what we do in the Northern Hemisphere, specifically Britain and France, when it's actually the hot nights of August, we actually get out the hot drinks and think of the autumn. In Australia, in the Antipodes, they do something completely different because, of course, it's their winter still, so it goes. Tosin, would you like to put those last two questions to Anna Lewis, please?
Okay. Hi, Anna. So, first question is, did you enjoy the Zuma with us?
I certainly did. Thank you.
Okay. And next question is, would you love to come back for another conversation about Irish coffee, driving, and graveyards?
And Balenciaga.
Great, great subjects. I'll be back anytime you want me. Thank you.
In fact, actually, Tosin, Balenciaga bondage could actually replace Afrobeats as a kind of two-header on Siren Radio each week. I'm not sure how Ryan will actually go to it. He'd probably sort of stress dealing with being called out by Victoria. But never mind, that's part and parcel of the whole thing. You know, Balenciaga bondage, it's
I'll
a thought. I'm
it.
Just putting it out there.
I'll think about it. I'll think about it. Yeah. I'll think about it.
Meanwhile, taking us around to the next feature, which is all about cars and electric charging points, of which there are very few in this country, but Vauxhall are trying to get many, many more. To take us around to that, it is Eddie Grant.
Avenue, and then we'll take it higher. Oh, we gonna rock down to Electric Avenue, and then we'll take it higher. Who is to blame in what country? Never can get to the one. Dealing in multiplication, and they still can't feed everyone. Oh no, we gonna rock down to Electric Avenue, and then we'll take it higher. Oh no, we gonna rock down to Electric Avenue, and then we'll take it higher. Out in the street, out in the street, out in the playground, in the dark side of town. Oh, we gonna rock down to Electric Avenue, and then we'll take it higher. Hey, we gonna rock down to Electric Avenue. Electric Avenue. Rock it in the night. Take it higher. Electric Avenue. Rock it in Miami, Miami. Electric Avenue.
Now, if you happen to be a motorist, and clearly a motorist who cares about the environment, it's highly likely that over the next few years, if you haven't already, you'll be looking at maybe actually going electric. Okay, fine. That seems perfectly reasonable. And you might then say, well, how do I actually get fuel for the car? How do I actually do the charging from that point of view? Well, 80% of EV charging is actually done at home. However, and nearly half of households, indeed 40%, don't have a driveway in which to actually install their systems. And indeed, a recent research by Vauxhall UK has revealed that over 70% of UK councils have no strategy in place to install any on-street residential charging points for electric vehicles. How do we address this challenge? Well, an individual who certainly will be able to maybe give us his thoughts on the whole process and how Vauxhall are particularly developing this side of things is the managing director of Vauxhall UK, the wonderful James Taylor. How are you, James?
I'm very good, thanks, Alex.
Now, this particular investigation, a Freedom of Information request, of course, it's a staggering figure, really. I mean, nearly three quarters of UK councils have no on-street EV charging strategy. Now, you know, I do a lot of travel between Lincoln, between Teesside and so on. I see a lot of terraced houses, end terraced house, etc. These are areas whereby, yeah, unless you try to stagger down to the one or two available charging points, there are issues with respect to this whole area.
Yeah, Alex, I mean, you've identified exactly the issue that the Electric Streets campaign that Vauxhall's launching today is trying to address. So we know that 80% of charging currently happens at home because it's the convenient and most cost-effective way of charging vehicles. And we know that 40% of UK households do not have a driveway, and that rises to up to 60% in urban areas. So Electric Streets is two things, really. So firstly, it's a website where any driver, they don't have to drive a Vauxhall, they can have an electric car today or thinking about having an electric car, can go and register their need for on-street charging. And that will help us create a heat map, which doesn't exist anywhere today, to identify where on-street charging demand is. And then we've also created an enablement fund where we'll work with some of the leading charge point providers to really help educate local councils on the need for this infrastructure, the different types of infrastructure that can be put in. And then by working that with our heat map, we can make sure they go into the right locations as well and ensure that the 40% of people without driveways aren't left behind and they're able to choose an electric vehicle as their next purchase.
Now, the UK has this target of installing 300,000 on-street charging points by, of course, the mystical year of 2030, when, as we know, the sales of new petrol vehicles will be made illegal and effectively the nudge towards getting e-vehicles will be very much in place there. And as we said, 7 in 10 councils haven't installed any to date. That's quite a challenging input, and there's an awful lot of potential roadworks that presumably needs to be done to actually achieve that target, surely.
Yeah, you're exactly right, Alex, in terms of the 300,000 government target in terms of chargers by 2030. We know today there's around about 15,000 on-street charging posts today. And through our research, they've identified that there's about 10,000 that will go in over the next 12 months. So we know the pace is accelerating, but clearly it needs to keep accelerating to make sure we get to that 300,000 target. That's why we've launched electricstreets.co.uk today, because we need to raise awareness. Councils have many different priorities, as we know. We've had COVID and now we've had the cost of living. But with the growth in electric vehicles coming, we have to make sure that those 40% of households without driveways aren't left behind.
Yeah, I was going to mention the cost of living crisis and so on. And clearly councils are known for having to juggle funds around in all manner of ways. This enablement fund, is it some way in which, as you said, that challenge of finding finances will be addressed? And have you had any interest so far with respect to the councils and local authorities of England, Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland?
Yeah, so the government have actually put a local electric vehicle infrastructure fund in place, which is hundreds of millions of pounds. So the funding is there in terms for councils to access. And really what Electric Streets is about is making sure we educate those councils on the need for this infrastructure and also support them then with this database, as I've said before, where drivers can go in and register their interest for electric charging on street and make sure that they then can put the right infrastructure into the right places and therefore make sure that those 40% of people without driveways can have access to an electric vehicle and convenient and affordable charging.
Connected Curb, of course, Sure Charge, char.gy, Chargy, they're all part of the operators that are kind of teaming up with Vauxhall from this point of view. I mean, clearly, from Vauxhall's interest, etc., your strategy is very much moving towards e-vehicles and so on. Do you feel as though this is an achievable objective, or is it a case of, well, you know, we've made a start here, but just as a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a couple of steps, this is where we're beginning to actually get these kind of initial heat maps together of where the crucial charge points are required?
Yeah, so obviously the government has set the legislation for 2030 for the banning of petrol and diesel cars. Vauxhall will have electric vehicles available in every single model in the range, whether that's a car or a light commercial vehicle, just next year. And we're committed to being an electric-only brand by 2028, so ahead of the government target of 2030. So we believe that the product plan is in place to deliver on the 2030 objective. But what we've got to do now is really accelerate the infrastructure, because we know from research that one of the biggest barriers to choosing an electric vehicle today is access to that local and convenient charging. And I think the best analogy is something like a postbox. So you need to make sure that on-street residential charging is in your local area and it is convenient to you. You don't necessarily expect it to be right outside your house, but it is going to be in a street that's very near to you. And that's what we need to work with the councils and the charge point providers you identify to really speed up the development of on-street charging now.
And in terms of rural areas, I mean, clearly Lincolnshire, an awful lot of rural activities going on there. Will there be any plans to look at villages and outliers from that point of view, as opposed to the urban environments?
Yeah, I think in terms of the 40% without off-street parking, we know that rises to 60%, but clearly in rural areas, there's going to still be a significant minority of households that don't have off-street parking. So in working with local councils, we need to make sure that everybody has access. And that's why I'd encourage anybody who's got an interest in an electric vehicle to go onto electricstreets.co.uk, register their interest for on-street residential charging. And that can really help us build this heat map around the country to make sure we then work with the councils, and where there is a need, whether that's a rural or an urban area, we can get those charging points installed in line with the demand.
Tempted to actually go out with the classic Eddie Grant song Electric Avenue, but maybe that's just too much of a cliche. James, if people want to actually find out further details, you mentioned it a couple of times already, to actually find out how Vauxhall UK are effectively working to coordinate this, would you like to just share the best place to go?
Yeah, everybody should go to electricstreets.co.uk, and in there you'll find about a wrap of information around this campaign, but also where you can register your interest for on-street charging.
James Taylor, Managing Director of Vauxhall UK, huge thanks, and inevitably we say the words, happy driving.
Thanks, Alex.